Okay, today we are doing chapter 24 of the commentary, which is chapter 11, the whole of chapter 11 of the Gita, and it is called the Divine Vision. This is another one of those sections, just like last week, where we have a very, very long Gita reading. I want to tell you the verse here that Swami describes is sort of a very free, he says, I crave the reader's indulgence and forgiveness, for I have offered here a very free paraphrase of the description of the divine vision. He said he took liberties even with Master's own translation of it, because he has long felt and the need for something more poetic in contemporary language. When I read that vision, I'll also tell you, Swamiji himself, when he was writing this, the whole process of writing this Gita commentary, he did it in India, and he wrote it in about, I think in about 8 or 9 weeks, a book he thought should take several years to write. He did it in a matter of weeks, because it just was given to him. Master just gave it to him every day. He just sort of, the words were there. He wrote 10 pages a day, no matter what else was going on. It actually required surprisingly little editing. And this particular chapter, he said he actually just decided he needed this poetic version, and he said he just wrote it straight out. And it was further proof in his own mind, not that he needed further proof, but it was further proof that Master was really inspiring him, because you can't just sit down and write poetry like that. You know, poetry requires, how do I say in just a few words very complex concepts? So he was very pleased with it. So this is in essence the entire of chapter 11 of the Gita, so I won't read the verse numbers. Arjuna said, in your compassion, you have revealed to me the secret wisdom of the self and have thereby banished my delusion. O lotus-eyed Krishna, you have spoken extensively of the beginning and end of all beings and of your eternal sovereignty. O great one, you have declared yourself to me. I accept as true everything you have said. And yet, O Purushottama, I long to behold you for myself in your infinite form. O Master, Lord of Yogis, if you deem me fit, reveal to me your infinite self. So what we have here is the disciple Arjuna has had Krishna tell him that, you know, Krishna in his fully expanded consciousness is one with the infinite. So Arjuna says, I have no reason to disbelieve you, Lord, but I would really like to see it with my own eyes. So there comes a time often in the disciple's life when he asks the guru for experiences. There's a very touching story about, Dr. Lewis, I sometimes forget which one it was, but one of Master's disciples kept asking him for an experience of cosmic consciousness, and Master kept putting him off. Forgive me, Dr. Lewis, if it wasn't you, but I think it was. And finally, Master said to Dr. Lewis, could you take it, doctor? And doctor realized that he couldn't. He couldn't have, in his own system, have taken all that energy in. I think Rajasi said once to someone who was begging him for that experience, first he said, if you had that experience, you would not be able to stand your life afterwards. Meaning that your normal consciousness is so far away from that if you had to go from that back to what you are, you wouldn't be able to bear it. So that's why it's giving it to us gradually, so that we can, both so that our nervous system won't burn up from all the energy, and also so that we're transitioning more gradually and it's more suitable to us. So on. Then Krishna answers, the Blessed Lord said, behold, O son of Prita, Arjuna, by hundreds and by thousands, my divine forms, multicolored, multifarious. Behold the Adityas, the Vasus, the Rudras, the twin Aswins, the Maruts, and many wonders hitherto unknown. Here and now, O Gudakesha, conqueror of sleep, Arjuna, behold, unified in my cosmic body, all the worlds, all that moves or is without movement, and all besides that you desire to behold. You cannot behold me with mortal eyes, however. Now, therefore, I give you divine sight. Behold my supreme yoga power. And then the scene shifts once again, and we remember that the entire Bhagavad Gita, which is the conversation between Arjuna and Krishna, is actually being told by Sanjaya to King Dhritarashtra. This is way back into the beginning when this whole Gita is a conversation between Arjuna and Krishna that takes place on the eve of battle in the middle of the epic Mahabharata, and Dhritarashtra is the father of the dark forces that are opposing Arjuna and his brothers. Krishna is driving the chariot. Arjuna says to Krishna, "I am reluctant to do battle." Krishna takes Arjuna aside and they have this conversation about why he should do battle. The external story is an actual war that was actually an historical war, but the field of battle is really the field of our own consciousness with the forces of delusion on one side and the forces of enlightenment on the other. And the Mahabharata epic describes the Gita, and the Mahabharata epic is said that Dhritarashtra, who's blind, who, as I said, is the sire of the forces of delusion, Sanjaya is his trusted counselor, because everybody's a mixture of good and evil. Sanjaya represents introspection. And the observation is, what did they do on the field of battle? And we said way back in the beginning classes that the whole thing is told in the past tense, because while we're in the heat of our struggle for self-realization, we can't see clearly what's happening. It's only as we introspect about the events of the past that we are able to understand it. So Dhritarashtra is at a distance from the battlefield. He wants to know what's happening to his sons, which is, Dhritarashtra is physically blind, and he represents the mind blinded by delusion, by attachment to the wrong qualities within him, because it's all us. That's what I'm trying to say. Dhritarashtra represents our own mind blinded by delusion. Sanjaya is given expanded sight for the duration of the battle, and he's able to report to the mind what happened in the battle between the light and dark forces. So now, after all of this conversation, Arjuna is asked to see the form of Krishna. Krishna says, "Here it is." And all of a sudden, Sanjaya says to Dhritarashtra in the middle of this, reminds us where this is all happening, with these words, "Hare Krishna, Hare Lord Krishna, the exalted Lord of Yoga, revealed to Arjuna his supreme divine form." And so then Sanjaya describes what Arjuna saw. Arjuna saw the supreme deity, infinite in variety, omnidirectional in radiance, all-pervading, as if adorned on all sides with celestial robes, garlands, and ornaments, the divine weapons, celestial powers, upraised as though ready for use, fragrant with exquisite essences and with faces and eyes seemingly everywhere. Were 1,000 suns to appear together in the sky, their brilliance could suggest only dimly the splendor of that exalted being. More bright than 1,000 suns is the poetic way that God is often described. This is not yet Swami's poem, I'll tell you. There, in that vision, did Arjuna behold the vast universe with its endless divisions, all united as one within the form of the God of gods. Then Dhananjaya, Arjuna, wonderstruck, the follicles on his arms raising their hairs in awe, prayerfully joined his palms together and, bowing his head to the Lord, exclaimed, marveling. And now these are the words of Arjuna that Swamiji put into his mouth. Most wonderful Lord, adored of gods, within thy cosmic form I behold the vast universe of beings, saints and sages divine sequestered in remote caves, their serpent nature, Kundalini, formerly virulent, now tamed, raised by love on the rod of awakening. Lord Brahma, God of gods, seated on the head of each sage, his seat, the shining lotus of 1,000 rays. O cosmic-bodied Lord of all worlds, I behold thee everywhere and in everything. Innumerable bodies, faces, eyes reveal thy energy. Inscrutable to me are your origins, your reigns, your endings, O blazing effulgence, overwhelming light. The glory of thy name spreads everywhere to darkest corners of the universe. Diademed with stars, wielding the mace of sovereign power, your discus of whirling vortices of light, dazzling, illuminating, thrilling all, immortal, supreme Brahman, supreme resting place of all created forms, guardian of eternal law, high wisdom's throne, thy self-born luster shields thy devotees from harm, protecting all beings and calling them to wakefulness in thee. O Sovereign One, the beings of earth, the astral gods, all awe-stricken, with folded palms offer thee adoration. With prostrations they enter thy cosmic temple and offer thee their love, their heart's devotion, their hymns rising to the starry dome of heaven. They worship thee and thee alone. The lights of heaven, blazing suns, the lamps of consciousness, hermits, sages, emperors of benign rule, noble heralds of thy peace, the strong, the powerful, desire-filled, ambitious, bow in wonder before thy radiant throne, or else fall before thee, fear-filled, vanquished, their petty lives consumed in the cosmic fire. Thee I behold. Thy feet walk everywhere. Thy countless limbs are active throughout space. Thy mouths consuming, thy eyes flashing, thy hair streaming out with energy across the sky. O thou joyous, overpowering, all-obliterating light, I stand trembling before thee, awe-filled. Egos, karmas, desires, ambitions, victories, all rush toward thee for reabsorption in thy bliss, or else soon crumble into wasted dust. So do the rushing rivers of innumerable lives flow impetuously, blindly to thy sea. Moths, drawn to a flame, there perish. So do human lives, drawn by ambition, ever hopeful, but ever doomed to devastation, the fog of passion obscuring from them the truth. Who art thou, Lord? What is thy cosmic will? What is thy purpose? To what end has all this been done? Then Krishna answers, the Blessed Lord said, I am Kala, I am time. Disguised as endless doom I come, I seize, I obliterate. Even were you not to fight, these foes you gaze upon at Kurukshetra would perish, Arjuna, slain by my mighty will. Indeed, I slew them long ago. You are but my instrument. Your destiny is to carry out my will. I need you not. It is you, Arjuna, who have need of me. I know the past, present, and future of all men. Make war for me if you would embrace eternal life and victory and bliss. Then Sanjaya comments. Sanjaya said, thus hearing, Arjuna with folded hands, trembling in awe, prostrated before Krishna and spoke these words. We're now out of Swami's poem. O Krishna, rightly does the world rejoice in thy glory. The demons, terrified in vain, seek refuge from thy wrath. And the multitudes of perfected beings bow in the surrender of true worship. Ah, how could they not pay thee homage? Thou more than exalted Lord, greater art thou than Brahma, who created all. O infinite being, God of gods, shelter of the universe, thou the imperishable, the manifested and unmanifested, the ultimate mystery, thou art the first of gods, the primal person, the refuge of the world. Thou alone knowest all there is to be known. Thou art the supreme goal. By thee is the universe pervaded, O thou of infinite form. Thou art Vayu, the wind. Thou art Yama, the destroyer and god of death. Thou art Agni, god of fire. Thou art Varuna, the sea god. Thou art Sasanka, the moon, and Prajapati, the grandsire of all. Hail, all hail to thee a thousand times. Hail and hail to thee again and yet again. Hail to thee in front, behind, and everywhere. Boundless in power and immeasurable in might, thou art in all, and therefore thou art all. For whatever disrespect I may have shown thee in jest, addressing thee as friend, companion, Krishna, Yadava, Krishna's family relationship to Arjuna, speaking carelessly, though with affection, and for any irreverence, I may have shown thee, O unshakable Lord, lightheartedly while eating, resting, walking, when we were seated together, whether by ourselves or in the company of others, for all such unintended slights, O illimitable Lord, I beg your forgiveness. Father of all beings, thou art of animate and inanimate alike. None is worthy of worship but thee, O great sublime, unequaled by anyone in the three worlds. Who can surpass thee, O Lord, of incomparable power? Therefore, O thou infinitely adorable, I cast myself humbly at thy feet, imploring thy pardon, as a father to his son, as a friend to a dear friend, as a lover to his beloved. Do thou, beloved Lord, forgive me. Overjoyed I am by this cosmic vision, never beheld before. Krishna, you understand there. Arjuna suddenly realizes who he's been treating as his friend and becomes very concerned. Arjuna goes on. Overjoyed I am by this cosmic vision, never beheld before. Yet I confess, my mind is not free from terror. Be merciful to me, O Lord of gods and shelter of the worlds. Show me thyself once again in thy limited human form. I long to see thee, O Krishna, in the form that is familiar to most, as four-armed Vishnu, diademed, his mace and discus held aloft, O Lord of a thousand arms, for the reassurance of many appear to me now in that known shape. Arjuna has lived with Krishna in his embodied form as a human, but the avatars are considered to be an expression of Vishnu. So he asks Krishna to at least retreat to the familiar form of the god Vishnu. Then Krishna responds, the blessed Lord said, by my grace, exercising my yoga power, I have revealed to you, as to none other, the supreme form of mine, radiant, infinite. No mortal man save thee alone, great hero of the Kuru dynasty, has looked upon my universal form, not by sacrifices, nor by gifts and charity, nor by noble works, nor by pious study of the Vedas, can that vision be attained. Be not fearful, nor bewildered by this vision of the holy impersonal aspect of my being. Take comfort, be glad at heart, and behold me in this, my humanly speaking, reassuring aspect. Then Sanjaya comments, having thus addressed Arjuna, Vasudeva, Krishna, appeared once again comfortingly to his disciple in his own human form. Arjuna said, O granter of all boons, Krishna, viewing you once again in the human form, I love, my mind is pacified, and I feel I am once more myself. The blessed Lord replied, very difficult is it to behold as you have done the vision of the divine universe. Even the gods yearn to see it. Its revelation, however, is not attained by penances or by faithfulness to scripture or by charities or by formal worship. O scorcher of foes, Arjuna, only by single-hearted devotion, achieved through deep yoga practice, is it possible to behold me and to become one with me, as you have done in my cosmic form. He who serves me alone, who makes me his only goal, who lovingly surrenders every thought of I to me, who releases all attachment to aught else, and who, beholding me in all, bears no ill will toward anyone, he, O Arjuna, enters my vast being. Thus ends the 11th chapter called The Divine Vision of the Upanishad of the Holy Bhagavad Gita in the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna discussing yoga and the science of God realization. Wow. It's quite something, isn't it? I think that you could spend all your life just really reading that over and over again. Then Swami just sticks in here for good measure, which I may yet read, but perhaps I'll breathe for a moment first. The whole poem, Samadhi, he thought this was a good place because essentially what Arjuna experiences, and in the Gita it says no other mortal has ever seen this, which is slightly to me puzzling. Swami doesn't explain it. But of course no mortal eyes can see it. But this is an unusual vision that Arjuna is able to look at the form of Krishna and then have all the everything disappear and see within him that infinite spirit. There's wonderful stories about when Krishna was a little boy and his foster mother, Yashodhara, once looked into his mouth and he opened his mouth and the way the story is told, she looked into the mouth of her child and she saw the whole universe in there. And she was inspired by it, but then she said, please, Lord, I really don't want to see the universe. I just want to see my little baby, so close your mouth again. And that's how the story was told. I mean, that's the essence of the story. But this is also, and it's an interesting moment because, of course, Arjuna's consciousness was of God realization. Arjuna was Yogananda in a previous incarnation. Krishna was Babaji in a previous incarnation. Both of them were free souls. But there was this little lila of these are not things that I know, but Arjuna couldn't continue in his reality if he saw Krishna in that infinite form. It had to come back to the roles they were playing, which was Krishna and Arjuna. Krishna had to shrink back down into the form that he knew. But there's that wonderful touching part where Krishna, for whatever disrespect I may have shown you in addressing you as friend or uncle or companion or by your name, now that I see who you really are, it's such an amazing balance. Swamiji has often told us that when he was living with Yogananda, which he did for the last 3.5 years of Master's life only, but Swami said, he's made the comment that of course he wouldn't trade those years for anything, but he said in some ways it's easier for us who never saw him in a human form, because in our minds that limiting reality was never imposed upon us. Swami talks about how as a young disciple he would meditate on the fact that Master was entirely with him in infinite consciousness and yet sitting in the next room dictating letters at the same time. And the conflict between it, sometimes Swami's mind would become so confused by it. And Swami tells the story himself about how he was just trying to meditate on the reconciliation of that. And Master, just the way Swami puts it, Master just walked over and handed him an apple at a certain point, which was partly just to give him something tangible in a form of blessing, but also just to sort of show him that all things are real at the same time. I don't know how the mind can actually grasp it. It's not a level of consciousness that I personally have a problem reconciling, because it doesn't come to me. But you can see, it's astonishing to read about it, and it helps us to appreciate where it is that we are going. I want to read Master's poem here too. Master told us to memorize this poem and recite it every day. And it's something to take really seriously. All of you know that the lines on the wall are excerpted from this. When we were putting this temple together in this form, we had thought from very early on that those spaces where those words now are would be an ideal place to put words. We'd seen temples in India where they had scripture verses on the wall. Some temples that one that we always really enjoyed. I mean, often there's a lot of verses, like there were, the whole wall was tiles, large tiles, like 2 feet by 4 feet, and there were just Gita verses all over the walls. I mean, like a quilt pattern almost. So when you would just sit there, you would be reading the Gita at all times, and it was, the tiled walls were the Gita verses, so there was never any escaping from it. So we had many different thoughts about what we could put here, and then all of a sudden, sort of the thought came to everyone at the same time, and Swami articulated it, why don't you use verses from Samadhi? And one of the reasons we wanted, among other reasons we wanted to do it, is this fact of God realization and the fact that all of our spiritual practice is focused toward this is what one of the primary distinguishing features of the path of self-realization. I talked about this in a different Gita class, that the goal is not merely to be a good person or to be happy or to have something happen to you after death. It's to transcend all, everything. And these words from the Samadhi poem and the whole Samadhi poem itself describe it. And this is Yogananda's contribution. Vanished the veils of light and shade, lifted every vapor of sorrow, sailed away all dawns of fleeting joy. Gone the dim sensory mirage, love, hate, health, disease, life, death. Perished these false shadows on the screen of duality. Waves of laughter, scillas of sarcasm, melancholic whirlpools melting in the vast sea of bliss. The storm of Maya stilled by magic wand of intuition deep. The universe, forgotten dream, subconsciously lurks, ready to invade my newly wakened memory divine. I live without the cosmic shadow, but it is not bereft of me. As the sea exists without the waves, but they breathe not without the sea. Dreams, wakings, states of deep turiya, sleep, present, past, future, no more for me, but ever present, all flowing, I, everywhere. Planets, stars, stardust, earth, volcanic bursts of doomsday cataclysms, creation's molding furnace, glaciers of silent x-rays, burning electron floods, thoughts of all men, past, present, to come, every blade of grass, myself, mankind, each particle of universal dust, anger, greed, good, bad, salvation, lust, I swallowed, transmuted all into a vast ocean of blood of my own one being, smoldering joy, off-puffed by meditation, blinding my tearful eyes, burst into immortal flames of bliss, consumed my tears, my frame, my all. Thou art I am thou, knowing, knower, known as one, tranquilled, unbroken thrill, eternally living, ever new peace, enjoyable beyond imagination of expectancy, samadhi, bliss, not an unconscious state or mental chloroform without willful return. Samadhi but extends my conscious realm beyond limits of the mortal frame to farthest boundary of eternity where I, the cosmic sea, watch the little ego floating in me. The sparrow, each grain of sand fall not without my sight. All space floats like an iceberg in my mental sea. Colossal container I of all things made by deeper, longer, thirsty, guru-given meditation comes the celestial samadhi. Mobile murmurs of atoms are heard. The dark earth, mountains, veils, low, molten liquid. Flowing seas change into vapors of nebulae. Om blows upon vapors, opening wondrously their veils. Oceans stand revealed, shining electrons, till at last sound of the cosmic drum vanish the grosser lights into eternal rays of all-pervading bliss. From joy I came, for joy I live, in sacred joy I melt. Ocean of mind, I drink all creation's waves. Four veils of solid, liquid, vapor, light lift aright. Myself in everything enters the great myself. Gone forever, fitful, flickering shadows of mortal memory. Spotless is my mental sky, below, ahead, and high above. Eternity and I, one united ray, a tiny bubble of laughter, I am become the sea of mirth itself. Om, 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 om. Isn't that fantastic that the entire thing ends, a tiny bubble of laughter? I mean, we take ourselves so seriously over the whole thing, and we have become the sea of mirth itself. And there's so much that is so extraordinarily deep in just those last two lines. Remember, you have all heard Master's voice. Many of you have heard Master's voice. Say it with me, a tiny bubble of laughter, I am become the sea of mirth itself. Say it again and again, every day, a tiny bubble of laughter, I am the sea of mirth itself. Again, again, he'll say. Why would he say that? Because we're so inclined to see ourselves in some other way. I was visiting, we were up at Ananda Village over the weekend, and one of my friends was speaking about the death. We were talking about a number of people at Ananda who've passed away over the last decades, and how extraordinarily some of them died in terms of their courage and their consciousness. And my friend was talking about this other woman who had died, Bella, and she said just in the last couple of days of her life, she had incurable cancer, and she just knew that it was the end of her life, and she'd made all the decisions about how to go, and she was just, they had taken her outside to just sit in the sun, and she turned to my friend and said simply, you know, I'm just sitting here, she says, and I'm just looking at all these faces, and they were all me, all these lifetimes that I've lived. You know, and it's so, how can, and she went on to say, how can she be concerned about this one body slipping away at this point? And when you think about that, I mean, just think of the intensity of experience of this lifetime that we've had. I mean, just today, I made some decisions and did a few little things that maybe I shouldn't have done, very small things. You know, email sometimes can be a menace because you can write quickly and say things that afterwards you think maybe if I'd considered more carefully I might not have said. We all do it. And then actually I just was speaking to Brenda when I came in and she was telling me about some little over-scrupulosity she was dealing with, and she heard Master say on a tape, just don't worry about any of these small things. Now, really, put that all in perspective. You have this picture of the infinite with this tremendous power and these things that he's talking about in here, about how he says, egos, karmas, desires, ambitions, victories, all rush toward thee for reabsorption in thy bliss. That's how we want them to go. Or else, soon crumble into wasted dust. So do the rushing rivers of innumerable lives. You know, we have this one thought that it's all going to resolve in bliss. And then this other part of this, where the Lord Krishna says to Arjuna, even were you not to fight these foes you gaze upon at Kurukshetra. Now this is going back to the eve of battle, and Arjuna says to Krishna, take me away, and I'm looking. So this is the whole discussion about whether or not Arjuna is actually going to literally pick up his sword in this physical war. But what it really is about is whether inwardly he's going to use, the devotee is going to use his willpower to battle the forces of delusion in our battle for the light. But he's now referring to the outward battle also, which is also a real thing. Even were you not to fight, these foes you gaze upon at Kurukshetra would perish, Arjuna, slain by my mighty will. Now what he's answering in there is the thought that we have, You are but my instrument, Krishna says. Your destiny is to carry out my will. But then the Lord says to Arjuna, but I don't really need you. You know, things will happen as they're meant to happen, whether you cooperate with the divine will or not. It is you, Arjuna, who have need of me. Yeah, that's just an amazing thought form there, because it's all about just shifting our sense of where does our life come from? You know, where do our actions come from? Where do our decisions come from? I've been thinking about this so much recently because just yesterday, Swamiji was, there's a young man who's doing, he's just starting to do a documentary about Master's life, and he was filming Swamiji several hours talking about Master. Then that film will be available eventually for all of us. And the man asked Swami, what was Master like? You know, how did he teach? And Swami was saying various things about how Master spoke in public, and he mentioned about his interest in communities and various things. But then Swami said what he said many times. But when he spoke to the disciples, he only talked about attunement. That's what he always talked about, was attunement. Now, you begin to start thinking about all the different things that Master could have said. But Swami said that many different times for the disciples. He only talked about attunement. He always emphasized attunement. So what is attunement? You know, attunement is this understanding that this force which I call myself is not really myself at all. I'm just an instrument of some vibration of consciousness. There is no separate self, that we have this such a strong impression that we are the origin of our own destiny. But in fact, we're just acting out these cosmic forces. We're really literally just a radio station. We're one of those automatic little cars, you know, that gets moved around. We tune in to some vibration of creation, and then we act according to that. And of course, all the forces in the universe are ultimately divine, but some of them are more fruitful for our bliss. This is what we're saying here. Everything ultimately rushes and is absorbed into bliss, or else it turns to dust anyway. That there's nothing lasting about our present reality. It's such an extraordinary thing just even to look back a little bit in history, how quickly things of this world just come and go. A friend of mine has given me a biography of Pearl S. Buck, who is a wonderful fiction writer, especially known for her book, The Good Earth. But you know, she at one point was just world-renowned. And now, you know, people know one thing that she did and hardly that. And even in the course of her lifetime, she got caught up in the politics of communism in America, and because she was Chinese and from China, and all these different things happened. She was enormously renowned, and then she was completely rejected by the world, even in her one lifetime. Helen McGinnis, who's a mystery writer, who was one of the best-selling writers in England just, you know, a few decades ago. Swamiji went into a bookstore, a used bookstore in England, looking for her books. The clerk didn't even know who she was, right? And they had none of her books. And it's just like we work so hard to have all this reality, but we're just waves on the sea, just expressing a particular vibration of consciousness. It just flows through us. And none of it is ever actually ours. We just choose to be a window through which, or a tube, or however you want to think of it, through which certain kinds of energy flow. But there's no fixed and lasting reality to any of that as long as we draw a circle around it. And we suffer so intensely over all the little things that happen through this small experience, but just from the slightest distance. You know, it just evaporates into nothing. And the only thing that holds it to us is this fixed determination that this is what my reality is. We're just so immature in that. And above all, once we reach this stage, Swami was asked the question which he's been asked before. Someone asked him directly, do you need a guru? Do I need a guru? The person asked Swami. Swami said, no, you don't need a guru. as long as you're content to live as you are. But at the point that you decide that God, that you really want to be in tune with the infinite consciousness, then you have to have someone, because the chasm, as he put it, between the ego and that infinite awareness cannot be bridged by the ego itself. Because the ego only knows this world. It just can't go beyond it. That was the meaning of Moses not being able to enter the promised land. It was because that's the self-definition, can't enter the promised land. It has to be completely shed. And there has to be a consciousness to take you across. And how does he take you across? He takes you across by you simply getting in tune with that vibration. And then as soon as we're in tune with that vibration, all that holds us to anything limited just automatically goes away, because we can't be both things at once. Oh, just like when you're singing and you're singing the right note, you can only sing the right note. You can't sing the wrong note simultaneously. Once you find that note and you start singing it, it's the only possible sound there is. If you're listening to the chorus, you listen, you find the note, you sing it, and then that becomes your whole self. That becomes entirely what you are. And once you do that, everything else you see is just an exercise in disentangling from all these wrong attitudes. And we use the study of scripture, we use rituals, we use charitable actions, we use all of these things to break the habit. You know, Master says little things, not little things, but like you learn to spend as freely for others as you would spend for yourself. It's a very interesting example, isn't it? I mean, oftentimes it's just a very good thing to practice when you think, oh, you know, something comes and a certain generous act is asked of you and you ask, well, if it was for me, I would spend it. And then why not spend as freely for someone else as you would spend for yourself? You know, it's a very good practice within common sense, but I think most of us have common sense. You know, a long time ago in my life, I sort of decided if an idea, a generous thought comes to me and the only reason I don't do it is because of, you know, greed or self-interest. You know, I make it a rule to do it. You know, if the thought occurs to me that this should be given away or bought for someone like that, within common sense reason, if it feels like it really ought to be done and the only thing is my selfishness, then we just steadfastly, universally, day after day, just simply work against that. I'm going to speak a moment about tithing, which is a subject I always like to enter into if I possibly can. But I'm going to put it this way. I was speaking to someone who recently has had financial setbacks, and one of the first responses to that financial setback was to stop tithing. And I was trying to explain to the person why that's such a really, really bad idea. And I wasn't successful, because the response I kept getting was, well, I don't have enough money now. And my answer was, well, that's why tithing, which is a percentage of whatever you have, is so much more dynamic than just giving money away. Because then if you have very little money, you give very little, but you still give the same percentage of what you have. That's why Moses, it came from the Old Testament, is the first time it's written, where it was one of the commandments that Moses brought back. A tithe of everything you have goes to the temple, is how he put it. Now, okay, you've all heard me say that many, many times. So I tried to think, what's another way to say this? Okay, if we think about a certain amount of money that we have, we are using that money to support ourselves. And when we say, I don't have enough money, that means I don't have enough to pay my rent, to pay my insurance for my car, to buy food, to buy health insurance, you know, whatever the bottom line requirements. And the reason we need that money is because we feel responsible for ourselves, don't we? And if any of us have children who are dependent upon us for our support, we also feel responsible for those children. Isn't that so? And we just think, well, no matter how much money I have, this is what I'm responsible for. But what we're trying to add to that is that we are responsible for God's work. We are responsible for the spiritual upliftment of this world, just as much as we are responsible for the maintenance of our body or for those individuals who may be dependent on us. And it's like, what are we actually doing on this planet? And The fact is, as Master put it so in his marvelously practical way, every good, noble, or philanthropic enterprise sooner or later comes down to a matter of money, which is if those who are conscious of the importance of maintaining an outward-moving spiritual uplifting energy into this world and are practical enough to realize that it has to have some form. There's that joke that's told, oh yes, I donate to God. I take everything that I have. Every time I get paid, I get it into cash and I throw the money in the air, and then God takes whatever he wants, and whatever falls to the earth I suspect is mine. But we have to recognize that it needs to take a tangible form. And at what point are we only responsible for maintaining our body, but we're no longer responsible for the spread of divine understanding to others? And is that really the position that we want to take? That at a certain point I just am going to be thinking about material things and what I'd call myself? Or is the bottom line of my responsibilities, does it also include the uplifting of others in a spiritual way? And you see, that's the principle of tithing, and that's why it's so powerful, is that this is just a fundamental responsibility that I have. So 10% goes to that. And if that means that with the 90%, I have only two meals a day instead of three, it's like I would take the money, the food out of my mouth before I take it out of the mouths of my children. And before I would take it back from God, I would take it out from myself. And you see, we have to do something that actually challenges us, that we can't just sort of wiggle out of. You know, we have to pin ourselves down and pin the ego down and not just always find a place that's comfortable. That's the extraordinary power of tithing, and that's why the spiritual benefit of it, it has absolutely nothing to do with Ananda or any other spiritual organization needing your money. I need you not. It is you, Arjuna, who have need of me. What are we going to be a channel for in this world? You know, are we going to channel our own personal ambitions and our own ego desires and then just have it turn to dust? Or are we going to attune ourselves to a more subtle reality and let that be the vibration that flows through us? When Master comes into this world, when Swami comes into this world, you see these great saints who will die, who will give everything they have. Well, let's back up a whole big step. They don't even have any reason to be here. You know, the Masters come into this world, they don't have any reason to be here. Every week in the Festival of Light, greater can no love be than this, from a life of infinite joy and freedom in God. From a life of infinite joy and freedom in God, willingly to embrace limitation, pain, and death for the salvation of mankind. Such ever has been the sacrifice of the great masters for the world. Now these masters, you know, are the same as us. They're not of a different order. It's not like they're a separate creation. That's why it's so important to constantly have that. That's why they take human form. That's why they live among us, because they want us to see. And that's why Master tells us about his previous incarnations and all the different things that you understand about how they've risen from the same reality that we've risen from. It's just a matter of degree. It's not something completely different. Because then the Festival of Light has been telling us the first stage of the journey is when God creates us. The second stage of the journey is when we rebel against the mission that God has given us and we go for the egoic self. The third stage of the mission is when that rebellion ceases to work and we begin to ask what the truth is. That's the quest. The mission, the revolt against that mission, the quest for truth. And then we have this wonderful paragraph about the consciousness of an avatar. But then it says, here then is the fourth and last stage, which all of us have to renounce completely all of our self-interest and realize that the only bliss we really have is in surrendering all this small identity and just embracing this destiny that we live for others. Now, that sounds so marvelous. How do we get there? So Moses says something really simple, like take every tenth one of your sheaves of wheat and every tenth one of your goats and give it to the temple. And then the shepherd says, but how will my family live? Moses says, do it, you know, because that's sacrificing everything. Can you imagine Master saying, well, gee, I don't have quite enough money. I think I'll go get a job selling shoes. There's a story that Swami tells in The Path, too, about Dayamata, who was, you know, utterly dedicated to Master. At one point she said, my mother is unwell and there's no one to take care of her. Perhaps I should leave this life at Mount Washington and go take care of my mother. Master responded by saying, get out right now, if that's how you feel. And she said, no, Master, I could never leave your this life. And he said, well, you know, she's in God's hands. Why would you turn away from your responsibility to this divine work, thinking that you would turn back to something merely human? And, you know, have faith that if you take care of the divine, then God will take care of you in all ways. It says in here, where does he say it? Let me just find it, what the words are. Thyself, let's see, supreme resting place of all created forms, guardian of eternal law, high wisdom's throne, thyself born luster shields thy devotees from harm, protecting all beings. It's a very interesting, and then calling them to wakefulness in thee. Then Master went on to say to Dayamata, you know, God will take care of her. And then he, in fact, invited her to live at Mount Washington. And so Dayamata's mother was taken care of by Master right there. But it was like, it was a temptation of Satan to try to take back what she'd given. You know that temptation in Swami writes that song for the devil in the oratorio, where the devil speaks to Jesus. He puts musically the temptation of Christ. You know, why don't you just take back what you've given? And then I'll take care of you in all these ways, Satan promises. Just all you have to do is take back what you've given. Just reclaim what you've given. That's how Satan says it to him. And that's sort of what why Master responded so to Dayamata. You've given your life to God. You've repudiated home and hearth for the sake of a greater reality. And now your little ego is anxious and wants to go back and do something about it and draw a small circle around itself. It was a very harsh answer. And the interesting part of it is, in fact, Master reached out and took care of her himself and brought her to live with them. But that phrase, if you'll just reclaim what you've given, and that was why I was working so hard with this individual to get them to understand, but you've promised this to God. You can't now say, oh, I'm too nervous, I can't do it anymore. And once again, that's why I over and over and over again plead with people to have your giving be a percentage. Because then you're not making a decision. It's whatever God gives you, you give a portion of it back. You don't stop and ever ask yourself whether I can afford it. It's not extra money. It never belongs to you. 90% is yours, 10% is God's. It's the fee we pay. But in every area of our life, you see, that's the challenge that God is asking us. And we need to attune ourselves to the powerful consciousness of those who know how to do this. I mentioned here a few, I talk about attunement a lot because it's the part of the spiritual path that makes the most sense to me, I guess. You know, I bog down in other parts of it. But this part somehow, it makes sense to me. The heart of a devotee. He says it in here somewhere about the heart. Well, it's not important, but it is important, where he says at the very end, he says, this revelation is not attained by penances, by faithfulness to scripture, by charities, or by worship, only by single-hearted devotion. And then he goes on to say, which is achieved through deep yoga practice, because single-hearted is as opposed to all the different desires of the heart. See, even Dayamata there, great soul that she is, you know, she had this deep devotion to Master, but her heart was also drawn toward her mother. Now, at a certain level of spiritual development, that would be an upward movement. That's an important thing to understand. If a person is selfish and is only living for themselves and isn't concerned about anyone, to realize that I owe my mother a great debt and I need to take care of my mother is an expansion from where the heart is. But once Dhyamata has given her life to her guru and has become a renunciate and has moved beyond all identity, to then become anxious about her mother, in her case, was to go backwards. And that's why Master was so strong with her about that. Not because the mother wasn't going to be taken care of, but because she needed to have the faith in God that her dharma was to live as a nun with a universal identity at that point. And she needed to have single-minded devotion and not have it be divided among the things that she turned her back on. I mean, that's why in Kali Yuga times, people's sense of renunciation was so drastic. You know, you'd just go into the monastery, the door would close, you'd go off to the desert, you'd go off to the Himalayas, you'd just cut all your ties entirely. Now, because the world is less, because the world itself is more elevated, as Master puts it, it's possible to be more in a more recognizably ordinary setting, and it's not such a threat to the inner renunciation. It's not necessary to draw the lines quite so rigidly. In fact, what you see is a sort of a merging of the spiritual and the ordinary life. But don't be fooled by that. That doesn't mean on any level that the totality of what we're giving is therefore any less. This sort of modern teaching that it means that you can just sort of do anything you want, you can have lots of stuff, you can indulge all your pleasures and still be spiritual because everything is spiritual. We're just kidding ourselves. And once you get into the easiest way to get there, the easiest and most powerful way is to just get on the wavelength of the Master. Because then you see no other thoughts arise. And I'm starting to say, in Master's advice to Rajasi, which I shared with you not just a few weeks ago, Master advised Rajasi, meditate on the eyes of the Guru, feel the consciousness, and then as deeply as you can, just immerse yourself in that consciousness. And that's one of the reasons Master wants us to repeat that poem, Samadhi, over and over again. Because it just, you say those words every day to yourself. Vanish the veils of light and shade. And then what comes right after that? Lifted every vapor of sorrow. The second line, lifted every vapor of sorrow, sailed away all dawns of fleeting joy. You just say those words and all the things that we're clinging to, you know, begin to go away by deeper, longer, thirsty, guru-given meditation comes this experience. And this is where the Gita here says, single-hearted devotion achieved through deep yoga practice. See, how do we get rid of all these different vrittis that grab us? And this is where, in the Gita, it also speaks of the tremendous power of Kriya. Because by the power of Kriya, we draw the energy from all its limited commitments throughout the chakras to the powerful focus at the spiritual eye, where we then are automatically in tune with that divine force. You know? Well, why don't we take a very short break, and then we can go on for just a little longer. I was asked one question during the break, and if there's any others, I can take them also. It was a section also I wanted to comment on. At one point, at the end of this whole vision, right after the part where egos, karmas, desires, ambitions, and victories all go for reabsorption into bliss or just fall into dust anyway, Arjuna asks the question, who art thou, Lord? What is thy cosmic will? What is thy purpose? To what end has all this been done? You know, the same words are echoed in the Festival of Light. You know, all that we thought was dark, light was but darkness. Who are we in reality? For what end were we made? He's asking the question of Krishna, who are you? But it's the same question, who are we in relation to you? And then the Blessed Lord replies, I am Kala, I am time. Disguised as endless doom, I come. I seize, I obliterate. It's not really the picture of the loving Divine Mother that we tend to cling to, is it? And then these lines, which I quoted earlier in a slightly different way, even were you not to fight these foes you gaze upon at Kurukshetra, even if you were not to fight, these foes you gaze upon at Kurukshetra would perish, Arjuna, slain by my mighty will. Indeed, I slew them long ago. You are but my instrument. Your destiny is to carry out my will. I need you not. It is you, Arjuna, who have need of me. Well, Sharmila was justifiably and honestly saying, well, but you know, it's right after this that Krishna said, that Arjuna says, Sharmila was saying, gee, you know, these are not very comforting thoughts. They sound a little bit like the, you know, the trembling supplicant in front of the mighty Lord, hoping that he doesn't bash your skull in. But of course, after this, it's that Arjuna says, oh Lord, please go back to that comforting shape you had. And it's right after this that Arjuna also says, oh dear, have I offended you? But this is actually, Swamiji said one of the things that we have to be able to expand into is a calm appreciation, really, of how profoundly impersonal the universe really is. See, the very thing that makes us cringe against that is that it just seems to threaten our little sense of self. You know, if he's just going to obliterate us, you know, well, the natural thought is, what about me? You know, what will happen to the me if I'm going to be obliterated like that? And Swamiji once, and it might even be in this book, he said something that was just so unusual, and it was about the state of consciousness he's experienced, but nothing I've ever experienced. He says, when you reach that stage of realization, where you recognize that there is only one consciousness, the way Swami said, there's a moment, as he put it, of intense loneliness. You know, you've transcended the sense of I, thou, of the comforting God. You've obliterated any external image of the infinite, and you realize that everything that is your own consciousness, and you're utterly singular in the world. There is a moment of intense loneliness. Isn't that remarkable? And then he says, then you realize that that state is bliss. And that moment passes. Is this Jesus on the cross crying out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? You know, just a moment of darkness before the light descends. I'm not qualified to speak. I'm standing with you all just speculating about it. But these are extraordinary mysteries to contemplate, and they're directional ways of understanding. And so this huge vastness is revealed to Arjuna, and he says, what is this? And Krishna answers in this extraordinary impersonal way. And he's talking about death. He's talking about the fact that everything in the world goes away. I was talking earlier about this great fame that people have, great wealth that people have. It's just, they have these huge moments, and then the wheels of time just turn, and the sands cover it, and it's all just gone away. And everything that we're clinging to, and Swami writes in either Self-Realization, Essence of Self-Realization, or the Conversations with Master, he said it like this. He said, Master said, Swami's quoting him, God eats people. And then Master went, that, you know, just eats people, you know, just snatches us up and eats us. And you think, not me. You know, I'm going to be lovingly cared for. But at a certain point, we have to become that impersonal about everything that we consider personal and realize that there's no self to be consumed in this way. I can't quote it exactly, I should memorize it, because there's a verse in the Rubaiyat, and I think it's the poetic paraphrase, and it's in the little moments of time taken from the Rubaiyat, the commentary, and it says, Since death is the fate ordained for all people, and yet our life was created by one who loves us, doesn't it make sense? Doesn't it seem inevitably true that death too is an act of love? It's much more beautifully stated, but it's just such a beautiful thought. How could the one who made us in love end our lives with anything but love? And this is where Krishna says, I look like doom, I obliterate all of you. But in fact, I know where I'm going with all of this. And that's that practice. It pushes it to an extreme level where we just have to practice what Master calls this extreme impersonality toward ourselves. And that little book Swami wrote, Sadhu Beware, which is about how to have the right attitude, which is just so bleak. It basically says, it's always your fault. Don't even try to think about it being anybody else's. Don't try to explain yourself. Don't try to get people to understand you. Don't imagine that they'll ever support you. Just, it's always about you. Just take it that way. And you know, and you just want to say, but. But it's like, if God realization is the goal, what are we protecting? When I've shared it with you before, and it's a very grim example, but it was such a dynamic one. When we had to go through all those lawsuits, and Swami was the main witness in a number of these things because the lawsuits that we went through were all an attack upon his work, and he had to be a witness. And he was really an awful witness most of the time because he absolutely refused, as he put it, to defend himself. He said, I am not here to protect my ego. I'm here to dissolve it. So he would answer questions. He would answer questions honestly, but any innocent person would have a vibration of trying to prove their point of view. And he had no such vibration. And the jury and the judge, they just had no idea even how to read it. You know, it wasn't really what he said. It was just the vibration of what he said. They didn't know where to put it because it was like, I have nothing to prove to anyone. And a person can affirm that, but even still there's something inside of it. But it also made him completely invincible because there was no way to injure him in that process because there was nobody to injure. He was just quietly in himself with Divine Mother, letting whatever it was happen. At one point, the battery on his hearing aid went out while he was being questioned. And he sort of, I don't know what he was hearing, but he just answered anyway. And he didn't even bother to mention it. It just seemed too unimportant to him. No, he wasn't being irresponsible. In fact, he said, if it hadn't been for the fact that we were all involved, if it had been just him, he wouldn't have even appeared. You know, he carried it through because there were too many others involved. But that's how impersonal you get. Well, the Lord comes to obliterate. What difference does it make? And yes, and that's where the false understanding comes of this sort of terror-stricken attitude. But what is there to be terror-stricken about the mere fact that we're all going to be a dust anyway? You see? That all of it's just going to go away. And then this is where he says, I know your fate, whether you fight or not. Everything is already determined by my will. You can cooperate or not cooperate. You can put out good energy or terrible energy. It really doesn't make any difference, my little smidgen of creation. You know, it's all about this mighty river anyway. Now, if we stop being frightened about that, we can become thrilled by it. Because it just makes everything so unimportant. When I stood in India at the confluence of the rivers at the place that's called whatever it's called, on the way to Badrinath, that I can't remember any of the words. No. Prayag. Yes, Deva Prayag. That's what it is, where these two rivers come together, and the little temple thing is built into a little triangle, and there you are, and this mighty rushing river is coming from this side, and this mighty rushing river is coming from that side, and there's a little sort of ropey thing or chain thing, or you can hang on, and then you can step onto a little platform where the water is up to your knees, and you can kind of, just splash around this. But, you know, you're just that far from being swept into the water. You know, just the slightest lack of commitment to your body, and you could have just shed your body. And that river wouldn't have even noticed. It would have just eaten you up, right? I mean, it was terrifying and it was thrilling to just stand there and just watch and just realize how easily the human body could just go. Everything that we cling to, how easily it could go. And that's really, it's just magnificent. That's the power of nature. This is the image of Kali. Kali with her necklet, garland of skulls, and her long tongue hanging out, and her sword upraised like this. She's just this force that just, that's what it's really like. And then with the other hand, she blesses you. Because what she's really obliterating, what Krishna's really obliterating, what time really obliterates, is the foes that Arjuna is facing at Kurukshetra, which is delusion. It's really delusion that's killed, because bliss always remains. From joy I came, for joy I live, in sacred joy I melt. A tiny bubble of laughter, I have become the sea of mirth itself. You see, that's the good news. All of this which seems destructive, actually in the end, is liberating. Well, any other questions, comments, thoughts? Yes, Patrick.
Okay. You talked about tithing before, So I'm coming back down to a lower level,
that's
I understand.
All right. Mm-hmm.
But what if your spouse is not of the same mind?
The question.
And you want to stay married.
And you want to stay married. Well, it has to be answered in the specific. It can't be answered in the general. There's no rule for that. It entirely depends on the actual circumstances. However, but let me answer it in a certain way. One has to just be really, really careful. You have to be really careful not to cause grief to a duty, not to be inattentive to an actual duty you have, but you also can't be afraid to stand up for what you know is true. So it's a very, very sensitive question. And it just really depends on how far you can go. Now, I'll give you an interesting example, though, because Rajasi Janakananda's wife, who's very seldom mentioned and is never part of the story, James J. Lin was Master's most advanced male disciple. He was a self-made millionaire. He was already well-established with a wife before he met Master. His wife is never mentioned. His wife, apparently, this is seldom told, and these stories would be so helpful. His wife, as I understand it, was not entirely mentally stable and violently opposed his participation in Master's work at all times. So he was always having to work around this opposition, and Master never told Rajasi just to walk away from her either. So it was a very tricky, thing he had to work with at all times. So I don't know exactly how he balanced that out, but that was something that he had to balance out. So if you have actual, genuine questions, we should talk about it personally. But one should certainly move to the limits of what you can do without creating disharmony for your own sake, and then how you expand those limits has to be a very strategic, personal question. Because if you do create too much negativity, it's not a good thing. And one is obligated by those commitments, and you have to follow them carefully. You can't just shake them off as unimportant, because they're not at all unimportant. People have grown to rely upon you. You've made promises. You have to keep them in the right way. So sometimes you just have to think very strategically how to work around it, and you should pray to God every day about it, to open doorways for you to be able to move according to your reality without damaging others who are relying upon you. Fair enough. Okay, good question. And that's why St. Paul said, if you're fortunate enough to be unmarried, perhaps you should stay that way. Although, what did he also say? It was far better to quote his rather colorful language, to marry than to burn, as he put, meaning burning with desire. So I loved Vivekananda's statement. He was talking about women. He said, if a woman is fortunate enough to escape the bondage of husband and children, just watch, she'll get a cat. Vivekananda, not Master. Yes. The question is, what is the origin of the tithe concept? Is 10% a fixed reality? Can it be modernized? No. When I actually went to look back in this, it's the same place where Moses goes up to Mount Sinai and gets the Ten Commandments is where he commands them to give a tithe, to give a tenth of everything that they have. And he literally describes, had things that had to be real explicit. You raise up your shepherd's crook, and then you put your flock through it, and then every tenth, animal you put aside for the support of the temple. And so the 10% was set there, and that's what tithe means, is 10%. So I don't know what it is, except I know that 10% is enough to frighten people. So I think that's probably one of the reasons it's the number. You know, you can get much smaller percentages and you feel much more comfortable. So we're always trying to bargain with people and say, well, if you can't do 10%, you know, just do 1%, do 2%. I say that because it's better to do a smaller percentage than to do nothing, but I think you should do 10 because it should frighten you. This should be an act of faith. This should be a real commitment. And if there's a very well-known prosperity guru whose name I don't remember, who said if you're not frightened every time you write your check, you should give more. He said it's meant to be an exercise in faith. And if you can just do it comfortably without it having any effect on your consciousness, then you ought to be doing more than that. Because it should be growing. It should be... Now, I don't necessarily subscribe to that, but I think it's an amusing statement. But 10% is enough. 10% is enough if you're very poor to make you feel like you don't have enough left. And 10% is enough if you're very rich to feel like you're giving away an awful lot of money. And so no matter how you move it, now here's the only other corroboration for it being the right number, was a survey that was done once asking people if they thought they had enough money. And everybody, no matter what income bracket they were in, I don't know how scientific this is, but this is how it was presented. Everybody, no matter what income bracket, said they would be fine if they only had 10% more. So I sort of think I think there's something just dynamic about that number. Well, okay. I think that's the whole story for tonight. Thank you all very much. See you next week.